all House Natural Resources to order. Jacqueline, do you want to take the roll call, please?
Chair Gunderson?
Present.
Vice Chair Knutson?
Here.
Vice Chair Curdy?
Here.
Representative Ferris Olson?
Here.
Representative Fielder?
Here.
Representative Fitzgerald?
Here.
Representative France?
Excused.
Representative Galloway?
Here.
Representative Gist?
Here.
Representative Malone?
Here.
Representative Marler?
Here.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Putnam?
Here.
Representative Walsh?
Here.
Representative Weatherwax?
Here.
Mr. Chair, quorum is present.
Okay, so we can get ready. So what we decided to do, since we're getting such a late start and we have to be back on the floor for another board at 6, is that we're going to hear HJ 27, SB 284, SB 302, and HB 695. We've got some EA to do, so we're going to do that tomorrow. We'll come in at right after floor session tomorrow, probably on adjournment, and knock out the EAs. So having said that, we'll start with HJ 27, and Representative Holmland, would you like to open your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ken Holmland. It's H-O-L-M-L-U-N-D. I'm Representative House District 38 in Miles City. This is a joint resolution of the Senate and the House requesting an interim study on funding options for Montana conservation districts and requiring a final result to be reported to the 68th legislature. You know, considering the work that conservation districts do with streams and with riparian areas, this could really qualify as a cleanup resolution. I didn't hear the usual amount of groaning that I get when I do something like that. Anyway, we have 58 conservation districts in the state of Montana that do a tremendous amount of work. A lot of this work is done for no remuneration. And so what we did this, as you're probably very well aware, we passed a bill that I carried that spent $1 million of general fund money to fill a hole that was created in the conservation district's appropriated funds. This was done because of the big drop in the coal money that would be the main funding source for conservation districts. But we're having to rely on general fund every year to backfill conservation districts that are not covered by the little bit that goes into the coal from the coal trust fund is really not the answer. This is not something that is really palatable for people, those of us that are in appropriations, and we're looking to really protect the funds that are in our general fund. So what we're looking for here is to put together a study committee, a study resolution group that could actually maybe come up with some ideas that would be a continuing source for conservation districts. And if you look on the back of the page there, yours might be a two-pager, but we're talking about a whole bunch of Montana organizations, conservation districts, DNRC and EQ, DEQ, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, Department of Agriculture, and then we've jokingly said that if we're able to get all these federal government groups in the same room at the same time, we could probably charge admission to watch the circus, and then we would be able to help cover that hole, but I don't think that's going to happen. So we would really appreciate your serious consideration of this study bill so that we can cover that hole that's going to be created this time by the lack of funding from the coal. And I'll sit for some other people and then answer questions.
Thank you, Representative Holmland. Do we have any proponents in the House? Any proponents? And I might just ask you if you could state your name, spell it. Please let us know if you have any affiliations, and keep it short.
Will do. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Boslow, spelled B-O-S-L-O-U-G-H, and I represent the Montana Association of Conservation Districts, Mr. Chairman, may I distribute these handouts?
Yes, ma'am.
I will try to keep my comments brief, as our board president, Jim Simpson, is planning to provide also a brief testimony over Zoom. Conservation districts are Montana's legislatively mandated local soil and water conservation authority. Montana's 58 conservation districts cross every county in the state, and at the heart of their work is voluntary, locally led conservation. Some of the projects and programs that districts carry out include irrigation efficiency, aquatic invasive species prevention, water quality projects, stream bank stabilization and restoration, forest fuels reduction, saline seep restoration, tree planting and shelter belts, water quality projects, weed control, fire and flood restoration, pollinator habitat restoration, rangeland management, soil health improvements, and they also have a track record of sponsoring collaborative research for wise use of resources on federal lands. Additionally, conservation districts also work on conservation education and Envirothon, as well as the 310 mandate, which is related to the Natural Streambed and Land Preservation Act. Conservation districts have an incredible return on investment, from the grant money they are able to bring to support local projects, to the unpaid hours donated by their boards of locally elected supervisors, to the conservation benefits to their communities and local agricultural producers. However, in the past decade, the financial support for conservation districts through the coal severance tax has unfortunately declined. At this point, it is time to search for a future funding mechanism so that districts do not have to come to the legislature year after year asking for their funding shortfalls to be covered. Conservation districts appreciate the support the legislature has offered during the session, and we want to work with you to find a long-term, fiscally responsible solution to support conservation districts moving forward. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I will be available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Boswell. Do we have any more proponents in the room? Any proponents? Rachel, do we have any proponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Jim Simpson.
Mr. Simpson, if you can keep it down to about 3 minutes, we'd really appreciate it.
I will do my best, Mr. Chairman. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jim Simpson, spelled S-I-M-P-S-O-N. I am here today representing the Montana Association of Conservation Districts. These 58 districts are responsible for and are local leaders in promoting wise use of our natural resources. Our statewide workforce of more than 400 unpaid supervisors have donated countless hours over 8 decades to conserve natural resources, and we want to continue to serve Montanans and our natural resources far in the future. Over the last 10 years, financial support for conservation districts, as you well know, has been eroded as coal tax revenues decline. While this 67th legislature has been meeting, concerns about future coal continues to decline. It is time to search for a future funding mechanism for conservation districts. Montana's 58 conservation districts ask this committee to support this study bill so that the 68th legislature will be presented with a well-thought-out replacement funding formula for conservation districts. Thank you for your time, and I will stay online to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Do we have Rog?
No, Mr. Chair.
He's not online. Do we have any more proponents online? Okay, do we have any opponents in the House? Any opponents? Seeing none, do we have any opponents online? None. Seeing none, do we have any informational witnesses in the House? Any informational witnesses? Seeing none, do we have any informational witnesses online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Anna Miller.
Ms. Miller, you're up.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
We just wanted to come forth. I work at Anna Miller at the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. I work in the Conservation Resource Development Division, and we're certainly available for any questions you have or to participate in any way should the bill move through and participate and help however the study is designated to move forward. And we thank Representative Holmgren for his help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. And it looks like we have Stacy Barta.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair. My name is Stacy Barta. For the record, S-T-A-C-E-Y-B-A-R-T-A. I also work within the CARD division within DNRC, State Coordinator for Rangelands, and I too am available for questions should there be any.
Thank you, Ms. Barta. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative France.
I think a question for Ms. I'm sorry, I missed your name.
Representative France, could you pull your mic up there?
Yes, I could, and I'll take my mask off and get squared away here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now you're on the record.
Thank you for your testimony. What's the current size, what's the current budget of the conservation districts that we're looking that so we know how much we're trying to raise?
So I guess I can speak to the current shortfall, which is just shy of $2 million in this year.
Out of a budget of?
Around $3
million. Okay. I guess my, so we're looking, okay, two-thirds of your budget is in the red. Okay. I guess the other question I have is whether you're familiar with the Montana Watershed Coordinating Council and local watershed groups and whether there might be some opportunity for consolidation between two groups that I see having a similar, if not identical, mission.
Yes, I am aware of MCC, and they're actually one of our close partners that we work with on a number of programs, including Big Sky Watershed Corps. In terms of the constituencies that we serve, MACD is specifically very focused on conservation districts, which are subdivisions of local government and have our board of locally elected supervisors, while MCC serves watershed groups, which are, I would say, probably less, they're not defined in statute in the same way that conservation districts are, and kind of span a different geographic scale in some instances. But the watershed groups do often work with conservation districts in partnership. So there is collaboration, but I do think in a way they serve different needs. One aspect that I would like to highlight, if you look in your pamphlet that you've been handed, is especially, for example, this is just one of the things, is the 310 mandate that conservation districts work on, which relates to the Stream Bed and Preservation Act, and that is a huge service that conservation districts provide to the state in terms of doing these permits, and those are done almost entirely on volunteer hours by conservation district supervisors. So that is one of the things. We do have a lot in common, I would say, but I think conservation districts kind of serve a specific constituency, if that makes sense. So,
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Just I appreciate that there are different constituencies and different responsibilities, but desperate times sometimes call for desperate measures. And I'm just wondering if this study resolution might be amended to, in your view, to just examine the potential for consolidating various natural resource initiatives that go on in rural Montana so that we perhaps could find some economies of scale.
I think that we, from the conservation district perspective, would prefer to keep this bill focused on districts specifically. They do provide a very strong focus on wise use and, again, have that locally elected guidance or, I guess, direction by locally elected officials, which I think is critical and is something that watershed groups do not have. Not that watershed groups should not exist, but I do think that is very important in terms of what CDs do and who they're directed by. It is local officials. It is local folks. And they're very important in terms of wise use of resources in Montana. So,
thank you for that answer, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boswell. Representative Fielder. Wave off. Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for, I forgot her name, Boswell? Rebecca? Got that part right, maybe.
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair? Ms. Boslow?
Boslow, yes.
Boslow, okay. Would it be feasible for us to get like a past P&L or a budget to the committee of what comes in, what goes out?
Yes, we can do that.
Here, that would help me understand your workings better.
Yes, absolutely. And we can provide all of this money that goes to districts goes through the DNRC Conservation Districts Bureau, well, CARD in general. So, yeah, I can provide that budget, or I'll send it to you, or they will send it to you.
Okay, one quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So just from your brochure, doing a quick little math, if you had 310 permits at $250, that's spending $777,500 of your budget right there?
So that, where are you looking? So that is actually, that is just the estimated value of donated hours. So that is not even in our budget. That's just part of the value that conservation districts provide in terms of the return on investment. So that's entirely...
Follow-up, but... Yeah. But see, it says you your average cost for permit is $250.
Correct.
So I'm assuming you had to have 310 permits down there further. So you take 310 permits at $250, you would have spent $77,500. That's why I'm just trying to wrap my head around all this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway. So 310, it's called the 310 mandate or 310 permit, and that actually refers to the bill that it was initially passed under. I hope that our brochure is clear. We can make it clear in the future. In terms of the average cost to process a permit being $250, that's the estimated cost in terms of volunteer time, as well as the cost of fuel and vehicle for folks to go out and look at these areas that are being permitted. And that number at the bottom, it's on this middle panel of the brochure, which is just shy of $1 million, rounding up. That's all just volunteer hours. So this is kind of just an estimate to show one aspect of that return on investment for conservation districts. And I admit this is actually probably a underestimation of the amount of hours that districts spend on these 310 permits.
Okay, thank you. One quick follow-up. You can follow-up. See how easily I get confused, so if you could send me something to clear it up, that'd be great.
Yes.
Follow-up?
Thank you. Yep, Mr. Chairman.
Did you have a follow-up? Okay. Representative Malone.
Mr. Chair, question for the good sponsor.
Representative Holmland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holmland,
I'm probably too close to CD since my wife is a supervisor. And when I was on the county commission, they came in looking for money, and I says, we give you two mills if you start charging for 310 permits that the state has mandated you to do without compensation. So who should pay for 310 permits, Mr. Representative Holmland?
Well, I'd like to say thank you for that question, but it's a loaded question. But Mr. Chair, Representative Malone, actually that was part of my close, but 310s were actually dropped on conservation districts without any funding. And so I think the people that get the 310 permits should be the ones paying for them, but that's not the way that it works out. The question was also asked here a little bit ago about the funding, and I believe Anna Miller might have she's an informational person. She might have the information on that. But.
Thank you.
Okay, any more questions? I have a couple, and probably for Ms. Boswell. Ms. Boswell, what's the largest expenditure that you have in, you know, from your budget? What's costing you the most to do?
Mr. Chairman, I will say Anna Miller is on the line and can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe it is the CD admin grants, which is basically the operational grants that provide the basic staffing and operation for conservation districts.
Okay. What's your projected shortfalls until we get back to put that bill into place and to take your recommendations from the study and implement them.
Mr. Chairman, so this, we also have House Bill 374, which was also sponsored by Representative Homeland, and that bill helped this current fiscal year by having $1 million backfill, mm-hmm. and then also basically providing funding for in the next biennium. It has a 2-year sunset, so it is very temporary, but basically providing funding to fill that gap from coal severance tax, depending on what it comes in. If it's higher or lower, it'll kind of fill that for the next biennium.
Okay.
So.
And also just suggestion, just looking at that to help Representative Galloway, maybe adding a the and apostrophe before that stream permitting 310 mandate.
Ah, yes.
Might help. Just saying.
No, I appreciate that. Very open to feedback, Mr. Chairman.
Great, so. great little packet there. Do we have any more questions from the panel? Any more questions? Seeing none, Rep Homeland, would you like Representative Malone to close for you?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. He could probably do a better job than I could because he's a lot closer to it than I am. But I do know that in eastern Montana, conservation districts are really, really critical. And I would imagine that's probably true in the central and in the west also. These people do a lot of work. One of the things that they did do was cover about 5 of the AIS stations that the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks couldn't really get anybody to step up and do it. One of them in Circle, Montana. And believe me, you have to want to live in Circle, Montana, to live in Circle, Montana. So with that, I'll close there.
Thank you, Representative Homeland. And that closes HJ 27. Let's open the hearing on Senate Bill 284.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senator a couple Temple. Handouts.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Russ Temple. Temple, for the record, is spelled T-E-M-P-E-L. Mr. Chair, Committee, today I bring you, first off, I'm District 4. I want to make sure you understand exactly where I live. District 14 goes from Haver to Great Falls to Whitlash. There's like 6,100 square miles. And in that area, we have 200 miles of federal highway, 240 miles of Montana state paved roads, and this is part of what we're talking about today, somewhere in the neighborhood of 280 miles of state secondary gravel roads. And I'll repeat that, 380 miles of state secondary gravel roads that the counties take care of. What this is a gravel pit bill application, Senate Bill 284. Pretty much a straightforward bill. What we're wanting to do is waive all fees, dues, and charges of any kind that the state requires the counties to pay for opening gravel pits or operating the gravel pits, as long as the gravel goes on that county's roads. And there's only 56 counties involved in this. That was supposed to be funny, but... It has become very cumbersome and expensive to open gravel pits. It's not uncommon for a cost to be $6,000 to $8,000 before you move a rock out of the ground. You have to satisfy sage grouse laws, environmental laws, and goes so on and so on. As you can see, the bill stays away from all sage grouse core area LECs. There was an amendment put on on the Senate floor. There was some question about it. Senator Mike Lang has worked very hard on sage grouse, and we didn't want to get into that. And you're probably going to hear more from opponents today. So if you look on that's on line 17, and it pretty much takes care of that. And to start out with DEQ was an opponent to this. They came in early on, both the director and the Ed Cole is the gravel pit guy with DEQ, and I think he's going to be today, in place of being a opponent, he's going to be information. So we've worked very close to try to get some of the things done. And in the past, I have an application here. It's 27 pages that the counties had to work with. And this is just the application. You have to have documentation of, and one county told me 90-some pages total documentation to back this up. So we've been working on the application with DEQ, and they're scaling the thing back. They've come in information on this rather than opponents, because I think they see some value in this. And basically what you're looking at is the county property tax that you pay at home. If you look on that thing I handed out, I circled what is road and bridge. You add those two up, comes close to 10. It's 8 to 10%. Those dollars are going toward paying those fees to the state, which your property or your income tax already supports. So basically, your property taxes are paying state fees that your income tax should be paying. So make sure I don't leave something out here. So bottom line, there was some issues with contractors to start out with, and they kind of worked their own bill out. And so this is just county, and it's for gravel on roads. And I'll sit and take questions, Mr. Chair and committee. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Senator Temple. Do we have any proponents in the House? Proponents.
Hi, my name is Larry Hendrickson, H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. I'm a county commissioner from Liberty County. And we're an extension of state government, and it seems really strange that we tax our people more to pay our friends and colleagues. All we do is we gravel the roads, we build the roads, we make it so the construction people can get there to the gravel pit, we make it so the fishermen can get to the places to fish, we gravel and build roads for the bird people to come and see the birds. So please support this bill.
Thank you, Commissioner. And do we have any more proponents in the House?
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for your time today. Joette Woods, Liberty County Commissioner. That's J-O-E-T-T-E, Woods, W-O-O-D-S. And I am a proponent on this bill as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do we have any more proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bryson. That's B-R-Y-S-O-N, and I'm here on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties. And before I forget, Mr. Gilbert, Bob Gilbert was here also on behalf of Phillips County, but he had to leave to get his wife to a medical appointment. So he is in favor of this bill, and I'm allowed to tell you that. Mr. Chair, members, MACO supports this bill for the obvious reasons, but I want to talk just real briefly about why this came forward, not necessarily through a resolution process, but because Senator Temple brought this to our attention at our annual conference. On the Senate side, there was a lot of discussion about this historical deal that was struck about 11 years ago to totally revamp the open cut permitting process. And for you legislators that have some seniority and might have remembered that restructuring of open cut had some agreements in place. We were going to get expedited review, easier turnaround on the review process, dedicate money and resources necessary to have the process not get bogged down. And I can tell you that we fast forward 12 years later and we have, as it was demonstrated, 25 and 90 page application processes and a lot of give and take back and forth with the department. But at the end of the day, what this bill does is specifically focus the attention on the revenue side for open cut and DEQ. It waives the 4.5 cents per cubic yard, and it waives the $1,500 application permit process. That application permit fee was only put in place in 2019. So we're going to go back to what we had before 2019 with an acknowledgement for this, and this is the simple reason why. Counties open gravel pits to put source material on the public roads for the benefit of the public. They don't open source permits to sell. They don't make money off of the source permits, and they don't do them particularly often for projects. The private sector makes money off of a gravel pit operation or an open cut operation because they sell those materials as part of their business plan, or they do it in conjunction with a project that was let and bid that they need the source material for. And I agree with the previous proponents that we tax our property taxpayers, including if you have a gravel operation that's private in the county. They pay property taxes so the county can get a permit to continue to put source material on public roads. There are about 840 permitted gravel pits, county gravel pits across the state. We're a low-volume user, so the fees associated with those 848 pits are pretty minimal as it relates to the fees that DEQ receives, because counties only get to the pits every so often to be able to put the source material that they can afford to on the roads that the constituents demand. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryson. Do you have any more proponents in the House? Any more proponents? Do you have any proponents online, Rachel?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Doug Martins.
Mr. Martins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Martins, M-A-R-T-E-N-S. I'm a Rosebud County Commissioner, and I would, in the interest of time, just say that this is a well-written bill. It will help us out a lot. I've also been asked by Yellowstone County Commissioners to commit them to be proponents to this bill, and we would urge it to pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Martins. Do you have any more proponents online, Rachel? Seeing none, no, do we have any opponents in the House?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Marks. I'm with the Montana Association of Land Trust. Glenn is spelled G-L-E-N-N. Marks is M-A-R-X. I'm not here to talk about gravel. Gravel's a good thing. I am here to talk a little bit about sage grouse. This bill's got two sections. Section one is about sage grouse, and section two is about everything else that you've heard so far. Back in 2013, the state of Montana made sage grouse conservation and sage grouse habitat protection a priority. They made it a priority because retaining management authority in the face of Endangered Species Act ramifications would enable us to better control our own future and provide economic opportunity for Montana. Section 1 of Senate Bill 284 is detrimental to that stated state policy. Gravel is needed, and gravel is where you find it. Everybody understands that. But a categorical waiver from sage grouse mitigation for all gravel pits within 24 million acres of general sage grouse habitat simply weakens the state sage grouse program. Some interesting facts are, if you take a look at lines 15 and 16 of the bill, it clearly states right now waivers can be requested on an individual basis. So right now, anybody can request a waiver from sage grouse mitigation on a gravel pit. Anybody can request one. Number two, nobody has. No gravel pits have yet requested a waiver of mitigation within sage grouse habitat. And number three, the 15 gravel pits that have gone through the mitigation process for sage grouse conservation have spent a total of about $5,700, or about $381 in mitigation per project. So there's not a problem here to fix. There's not a justification for an overall blanket waiver for all of the potential gravel pits in 24 million acres of general sage grouse habitat. The individual waiver allowance that exists right now, let's keep that in place. That should continue to belong in state statute. And gravel pits that want to seek an individual waiver ought to be able to do that. And the Montana Sage Grouse Oversight Team, which your vice chair is part of, ought to be able to evaluate those applications on a one-by-one basis. This, but unneeded, unused blanket waiver opportunities diminish the strength.
Mr. Marks, could I ask, have you read the bill as we're looking at it? Because I'm not reading what you're telling me on, are you saying page 1, line 14?
Lines 15 and 16 allow individual waivers to take place. If you go down to lines 25 through 27, that's where the waiver takes place. The waiver takes place everywhere outside of core sage-grouse habitat. So that means blanket waivers inside general sage-grouse habitat.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to tie up your idea. Yes, please.
Okay. I am. We should not willingly take steps that undermine the integrity of our program itself. We should not chip away at the program at the risk of undermining the ability of us to retain state authority of sage-grouse in the face of declining populations all throughout its range. We understand that gravel needs to be mined. We don't have any problem with gravel being mined. We do think there is an existing portion of the state law that clearly allows that. We would just advocate that portion of this state law continued to be in place, and you strike lines 25 through 27 of the bill, and you can keep everything else the same, and most of the stuff that the people have talked about here would just continue to roll just fine. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And the next opponent in the House. Any more opponents in the House? Seeing none, do we have any opponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Amy Seaman.
Ms. Seaman.
Hello, Chairman Gunderson, members of the committee. Amy Seaman, S-E-A-M-A-N, here on behalf of Montana Audubon in opposition to SB 28. Mr. Marks there summed up our issues that we see with this bill right now as it presents to the Sage Grouse Stewardship Program. And primarily, like he was saying, that the right now we're not seeing a problem because there's already the ability for a project proponent, in this case, someone from county, state, or town sponsored gravel pits to work with the MSCOT program if they would need to work on their compensatory mitigation because it was an economic hardship. So we do see this bill as well as a major cut and sort of the first major effort to weaken the state conservation program. And again, it still would apply, as he mentioned, to 24 million acres of general habitat. We're really concerned about this because we do want Montana to maintain primacy over the management of this bird. And we have not seen that it is an actual economic hardship to the gravel, an economic hardship to the project proponents, as was mentioned. The other few things, just as far as the gravel pits, you know, we hear often that they're high and dry, they're out of the way. They're not an issue to the landscape, but really we know any gravel pit will create sediment that goes downhill either by wind or water. And so that is an issue. And really getting rid of a permit process gets rid of that nexus for looking at those issues that are caused. And so the proponents did allude a little bit to work that was done a decade ago to revamp the permitting process. We've heard the same thing, and on the Senate floor, it was a pretty strong talking point that that fee actually goes directly to an FTE through DEQ that's based out of Helena. And we have not seen that that's identified somewhere and removed. So it is kind of, it's money that would be lost without replacement. And I think if there are still issues with permitting, getting rid of staff will definitely not make that go faster. And I guess the one thing I'll add as well on a second reading of the bill and thinking about this is thinking about those program fees as they relate to the annual operation of these pits. And so while we haven't seen a huge acreage in counties open up since the Sage-Grouse Stewardship Act was enacted, removing annual fees for permits that are already acting, if we're reading it correctly, that would seem even retroactive and would kind of apply to those that are existing. Maybe that's a question the committee can answer. Other than that, we're around for questions, but we would urge a no vote on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Seaman. And who's our next opponent?
Mr. Chair, Ann Hedges.
Ms. Hedges.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ann Hedges with the Montana Environmental Information Center. And I think most issues have been covered. Just one last thing to mention is if you take away this money from DEQ, that it is generating from the work it does, and that is work that it has to do, reviewing permits, et cetera, then that means that DEQ is going to have the same amount of staff, or less staff, I'm sorry, to be able to do the same amount of work. And we know that it's not just these types of gravel operations that DEQ has to review. They have to review much larger projects. And you're spreading DEQ staff more thin across these permitting projects. We think that that is a detriment across the board to every one of the gravel pit permitting operations that DEQ has to review. We think it's unnecessary. We don't think it's that much money spread across this greater landscape. And I don't see any way to backfill that money for the agency. This is a program that does matter to a lot of people in rural Montana who have to live near gravel pits moving forward. And we want to make sure that DEQ maintains the resources to be responsive to everybody, both gravel pit operators as well as the communities in which they're operating. And we think this bill takes us in the wrong direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hedges. Do we have any more opponents online? Seeing none, do we have any informational witnesses in the House?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Klemp. Last name spelled K-L-E, M as in Mary, P as in Paul. I'm the acting administrator for the Air, Energy, and Mining Division. I also have with me Mr. Ed Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N. He is the Bureau Chief of the Coal and Open Cut Mining Bureau. And we are available should you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klemp. And do we have Mr. Coleman in here, or is he on? Okay, you're not on Zoom. And we'll get back with you. I show another informational witness online, Mr. Cronin.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christopher Cronin, and I am the section supervisor of the Department of Environmental Quality's Open Cut Mining Program. I'm here to answer questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cronin. Do we have any more informational witnesses? Seeing none. Questions from the committee? Representative Walsh.
Mr. Chair, a question for Dave Klemp, because
he's here. Mr. Klemp?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walsh.
Yes, we just passed. Just, it seems like about 5 years ago, but House Bill 53 was a bill that addressed open cut mining and addressed gravel pits. With that enactment, does this bill add to it or change it, or is it necessary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walsh, I'm not familiar with House Bill 53. I am familiar with House Bill 599, which Senate Bill 53.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walsh, Senate Bill 53 does not affect the open cut operations. That was in the Hard Rock Mining Bureau.
But it doesn't. I thought it was. We were going to addressing some gravel pit issues for counties and small operators and those type of things. Maybe I'm wrong.
If I might answer that, that's HB 599, and that's Open Cut 2.0.
Okay.
And it works with, I believe, SB 253 from last session.
Mr. Chairman, 343.
343. My memory isn't good. And so that answers your question. What you're speaking of is HB 599, the open cut bill, but it doesn't really address the same issues here.
Okay. We're doing a lot of gravel pits, and I didn't know which one we were doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Klemp. Any more questions from the committee? Representative Malone.
Mr. Chair, question for a good sponsor, Senator Temple.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator, is this a waiver from sage grouse? Is all I see, and they're not DEQ open cut permit.
Which... No, basically, when Mr. Chair, Representative, when I first started talking about this bill, I had no idea that I was even worried about a sage grouse. Senator Lang got a hold of me and said, hey, I've dealt with sage grouse for the last 15 years, and he's worked very hard on it, and he's the one that put the amendment on to take care of the fact that we stayed, 6/10 of a mile away from any active lek. Does that answer the question?
Follow-up, I guess. And
follow-up?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I know how DEQ can impact the county and been down that road too many times personally, but I don't think the sage grouse amendment fits on there, but that's not a question, sorry. Do you think it fits on there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, like I say, I had no clue that it even had to be on there when I was dealing with it. Senator Lang came in, he put the amendment on. I didn't see where it really hurt anything, and I left it at that and felt good about it up until today when I heard some opposition. So,
all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any more questions from the committee? Representative Fitzgerald.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick overview for Mr. Bryson, please.
Mr. Bryson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fitzgerald.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bryson, 56 counties, a horrendous amount of pages for permits in terms of time and effort, and then dealing with all the other permits. Have you got any numbers that would reflect, number one, the cost on an average per county or even total per state that we're sitting there having to put up with on small gravel pits? As I remember, the last pit bill we had was 10,000, was it 10,000 cubic yards? Whatever, but it appears to me that we're getting caught all the way around, not only on taxes and permit fees and everything else. Is there any kind of an economic impact to the counties that's been added up, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I think that means we're supposed to adjourn.
Can I put it up there?
Mr. Bryson can adapt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is going to be awkward. I'm going to try and hold this and talk into two mics. Briefly, let me give you some information. I think that's responsive to your request. I think I mentioned pretty fast in my opening that there are 848 open pits that are out there. And I talked about counties being low-volume utilizers. You know that because when you look at the fiscal note and it talks about the diminished fees that are out there, DEQ in previous testimony, and they can confirm that, showed that counties, the public source material pits, are about 20% of their application process workload. So 20%, but we're about 8% of their fees. Eight. Because we don't take a whole lot of volume out, and that 4.5 cents a cubic yard is pretty minimal as it relates to the income generated in open cut from the fees that are currently in place. But those 848 pits out there have been, I think it's safe to say, at one point in time permitted at a cost of, under the current law, $1,500 for an application, $1,500 for the application, $750 for a modification if it's within 10 years of the original permit, and $1,500 if it's greater than 10 years. In addition to that, the counties pay, this is the information that we gathered from our membership, on average between $3,000 and $5,000 in the technical engineering portion of it, i.e. hiring competent professionals to submit and fulfill the application and do the back and forth with DEQ each time they open a pit. So there's two different ways to look at this. It's the outlay for the public sector to get the source material available for public roads, which on average is that roughly $3,000 to $5,000 per pit that they open, plus the cubic yards at 4.5 yards, which is entirely contingent on volume, and then what it costs DEQ to do the work. And I think it's safe to say, in looking at them as informational at this point, that they think they can absorb the work with the existing staff that they have, and that the diminished revenue on their side is made up significantly on the public sector side by working with DEQ as our partners to do the expedited review, the easy process for the high and dry, the limited the provisions for limited open cut operations for those for pretty small volume and low displaced acreage operations out there, so we can get source material on the ground as efficiently as possible. The fiscal note says, I think, $40,000. That's the short answer to your question, but you know it's much more than that because each county that applies has the technical $3,000 to $5,000 per application that they invest in as well.
Mr. Bryson, if I could interject something, it's $55,494.
I've missed $5,494. Thank you for the clarification.
We'll get a copy of that out here shortly for everybody.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, just quick.
Follow up.
Mr. Bryson, while you're up there, as I remember, last session, both private and county pits and pit applications and pit maintenance, is there any number on the number of pits that have been forced to reclaim prematurely because of DEQ's pressure, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fitzgerald, the bill you're talking about last session put a penalty in place for opening and keeping open gravel pits, and counties were particularly highlighted in that if it was an inactive pit for a certain period of time, the bill contemplated forcing closure or incentivizing closure by putting a cost attributed to unused pits. We objected to that for the reason that we've already talked about today. It might be 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years before the cycle of county operations get back to that far quarter of a county to be able to use the source material that's been permitted and open but unused for several years to get the material on the ground. That cost estimate that we were talking about last year, I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm not going to try and quote it because somebody will correct me. But it was significant, but it was the reverse of what's in current law. It was a penalty for keeping public source pits open for the infrequent use of those pits.
Thank you, Mr. Bryson, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the panel, Mr. Curdy, or Representative Curdy?
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Marks.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Curdy.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Marks, so how much have we put into state money have we put into the Sage-Grouse program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Curdy, the program was provided with $10 million of general fund with the express purpose of retaining state authority and keeping Sage-Grouse off of the endangered species list.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, follow up.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Marks, so, I hate to speculate, but what could generally happen if the sage grouse went on to the endangered species list out here, near the Lex, in this area we're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Curdy, right now in many parts of the country, the sage grouse population is actually not doing very well. There was just a study released, and it had some very dire news. It showed that sage grouse populations have declined 80% range wide since 1965, with 40% of that coming since 2002. That's from the U.S. Geological Survey. We in Montana have decently stable populations, more so than 9 of the other states. So what we need to do, we need to retain
we need to retain the integrity of our program. So if the sage grouse is listed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in nine other states, we in Montana and they in Wyoming can point to the integrity of their programs and say, we have done a great job managing this species. We do not need federal help. We do not need federal authority. We can retain authority ourselves. And for those of you who want to look back, at once upon a time, the state did have authority over grizzly bears. We lost that state authority. How's that working out? Not that great. So we should do everything that we can to retain state authority. And we are talking eastern Montana. We are talking coal. We are talking wind power. We are talking solar. We are talking oil and gas. We are talking about a lot of economic opportunity. And the purpose of this program is to make sure that we protect sage grouse habitat, sage grouse populations, and at the same time, find a way to say yes to economic development projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marks.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Any more questions from the panel? I'll take just a second here while they move that. There we go. Thank you, sirs. Seeing, do you have any questions, Vice Chair? I've got a couple questions. I'm going to pick on Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman.
And just real quick, I don't want to take a lot of time on it. I was one of the shakers and movers on SB 343, and I think we did a pretty good job of curtailing a lot of the costs and things like that. And Mr. Bryson brought up a good point that there are many, many, many gravel pits that are local government county type gravel pits. And I know in Lincoln County, we have 8. And that's one of the biggest problems that we had was that as you go around that cycle of repairing roads, you may not get back to a pit for quite some time. Now with 599, we took care of a couple small minor things like the easy form, and we got a deep, deep form down to a manageable level. Do you see this bill as being an improvement upon 599?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that it dovetails well with it. With the increased efficiencies from House Bill 599, I think we will see additional efficiencies and cost savings so that we can handle a loss of revenue.
Okay. Are you familiar with M. Scott and the how they work with the sage grouse?
Mr. Chair, vaguely, as it relates to gravel pits and coal mines.
Okay. And I was kind of hoping we'd have somebody from that would be an informational witness we could call on, but it doesn't look like we have anybody. Mr. Cronin, you were a section chief.
Mr. Chairman,
do you have any information on MSCOT and how it how the sage grouse are doing with gravel pits around them?
I'm afraid, sir, that I supervise the Opa-Cup mining, and the sage grouse is peripheral to my efforts.
Okay, I was just reaching out and trying to grasp a straw, and I guess it isn't there. I'll turn it over to Vice Chair Knutson.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask the sponsor a question, please.
Sponsor?
Mr. Chair, Representative?
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator, you said that it was Senator Mike Lang who put the amendment on this bill. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. Representative.
Follow-up.
Senator, and you also stated that Senator Lang had worked a long time with the sage grouse population and the sage grouse program. Is that correct? Am I quoting you correctly?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have confidence that Senator Lang probably was looking out for the best interests, balancing the best interests of the sage-grouse program, as well as trying to help the counties?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's best interest of both.
Thank you.
And I guess just one question, Senator, on page 2, line 5, that's where you're taking out the fees that are normally associated with open cut for the counties?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. I guess seeing no more questions, would you like to close on your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I had kind of a long closing, and I appreciate where you guys are at today.
Fine.
The reason I left the map on there, and I was going to go into that, but you can look on the little key there that shows how many actual state roads and county roads there. Well, the state roads are on there. Not all the county gravel roads are on there. So anyway, long story short, our property taxes are paying what our income tax should be paying. Just please vote yes on this bill, and I'll leave it at that. And if you would pass this forward, I appreciate it. And if you have a past commissioner that would be willing to carry it on the floor, I'd appreciate that.
Senator, would that possibly be Representative Malone, maybe?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That narrows it
down. And I appreciate your committee, and thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator. And this closes the hearing on SB 284. Hey, could I have a couple of those maps? Okay, Senator. Senator Sales, would you like to open on your bill?
I would, and thank you, and good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Walt Sales, Senate District 35, which is the northwestern parts of Gallatin County, Broadwater County, and parts of Lewis and Clark. Today I bring you Senate Bill 302, which is just an extension of a deadline for authorization to continue the use of navigable riverbeds. Very simply, the bill gives a four-year extension, as you can see on page 1, line 15, and also adds an immediate effective date, turning over to page 3, line 6. So in 77.1.11.12, subsection 1, that's where it lays out the process for authorization to use for folks who want to continue using the bed of a navigable river, receiving either a lease, license, or an easement by the department. So in visiting with the department, it became apparent that time is still needed to reach the individuals that are using these waterways. And the request then, as you see, is for a 4 years extension that will meet those needs that they see. So, Senate Bill 302 is a simple extension of time. We'll protect the users along those waterways, and I look forward to this, the discussion that you'll have. And, Mr. Chair, I'll take questions as you need.
Thank you, Senator Sales. Do we have any proponents in the House?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Krista Lee Evans. I'm here today on behalf of the Senior Water Rights Coalition and AGGI, the Association of Gallatin Agricultural Irrigators, and we stand in strong support of Senate Bill 302. This bill is essential to extend the timeline for the opportunity for our diversion owners to file for a lease, license, or easement with the state. We are committed to working with the department and all the other groups, ag-based groups and others, to get the word out to folks so that they can get this critical lease, license, or easement applied for. So the 4 years is a realistic amount of time, and we strongly urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Do we have any more proponents in the House?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Murphy, representing the Montana Water Resources Association. We also stand in support. We see this as a very important issue from the standpoint of those irrigation projects and those water rights that are impacted by the use of these areas within navigable streams and rivers. And so we do see this as a very important extension of time, and we do hope that in the interim that information through the department and others can be provided out there to those that are impacted to make sure that those who need to obtain an easement lease continue utilization of their water right within these navigable rivers is perfected. And so with that, again, Mr. Chairman, we stand in support of Senate Bill 302.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. And our next proponent.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rayleigh Honeycutt, H-O-N-E-Y-C-U-T-T, with the Montana Stock Growers Association. We stand in strong support of this bill as well. As the bill sponsor mentioned, this is just a deadline extension. We feel that that is attainable in working with the department, and also our organization is committed to doing outreach on behalf of outreach to our members to make sure that they're aware of this deadline to make sure and ensure that they have their lease license or easement in place by 2025. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Honeycutt. Any more proponents?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Cone, C-O-N-E, and I'm here today on behalf of the Montana Farm Bureau Federation. We also are in strong support of Senate Bill 302, and we would like to thank the sponsor for bringing this. And the bill just simply extends the date for water users to file to be able to continue the use of the navigable riverbeds, and we want to allow more opportunity for our members to take advantage of this. We also agree that we are committed to taking time to make people aware of this and educate them on the benefits of filing for this approval. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cohn. Do we have any more proponents?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Colin Cooney. That's C-O-O-N-E-Y here on behalf of Trout Unlimited. We just wanted to offer our support for Senate Bill 302. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooney. Do we have any more proponents in the House? Proponents in the House. Do we have any online, Rachel? Okay, seeing none. Do we have any opponents in the House? Do we have any opponents in the House? Rachel, do we have any opponents online? Seeing none. Do we have any informational witnesses in the House? Informational witnesses? How about online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Sean Thomas.
Mr. Thomas.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Thomas. That's Sean spelt with a W, last name T-H-O-M-A-S. I'm the Division Administrator for the Trust Land Management Division of the DNRC. We oversee navigable river authorities in the state of Montana. I'm available if you have any questions. I believe one of our attorneys, Brian Bramlett, is also available if you need questions that I can't answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. So, Mr. Bramlett, are you also available?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Bramlett, last name B-R-A-M-B-L-E-T-T. I'm an attorney with the department and work on navigable river issues if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bramlett. Do we have any questions from the committee? Any Representative Putnam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thomas, how many of these exemptions have been granted since this program went into place?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so the original creation of this legislation that allowed for this to occur has led to six applications under this particular provision of law for these uses. There have been other requests for easements for crossings of navigable waters and other uses that have been done under other authorities involving navigable rivers, but under this particular statute for historics, there has been six.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thomas, do you have any idea how many more of these might show up? How many more might be out there that have not filed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I do not. One of the other water users may have a better indication of what that might be.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Follow-up. Is there any other proponents or informational people that might know that answer?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Crystal Lee Evans, and Representative Putnam, that's kind of a moving target. If you look at subsection 1 of 77.1.11.12, that has to do with footprints that existed before October 1, 2011, and for rivers that have already been deemed navigable for tidal. And so what this process does is, for example, like the Yellowstone, certain stretches of the Missouri, those have been deemed navigable for tidal by a court of competent jurisdiction. And on those, if you have an irrigation diversion structure, there's probably, as long as you're below the low water mark, there's probably hundreds out there that haven't filed. But what this statute also does is it also contemplates, as additional sources or rivers or streams are deemed navigable for tidal by a court, then existing structures in place when the court acts, they then can use this statute to apply as well. So there are some rivers and streams in Montana where a court has already deemed them navigable for tidal, and there's probably hundreds within that statewide. That really just depends on when and where and if the state asserts that different sources are navigable for tidal, because once that occurs, there'll be more.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Ms. Evans, I got one for you.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Evans, what's considered navigable? Can you give me a definition?
Just a second.
Without looking.
Well, I kind of can. So in these statutes, navigable is deemed that only a court of competent jurisdiction can say that it's navigable for tidal. And navigable for tidal is different than navigable being able to float a boat down it. So navigable for tidal is based on the natural flow of a stream used for commercial purposes, so in its natural state. So back in the day, so for example, there's certain streams. Sheep Creek always comes up, and it's over outside of White Sulphur. Sheep Creek was used to float logs. However, it wasn't in its natural state because they would dam up the creek and then blow the dam to have enough flow to move the logs. So navigable for tidal is different than navigable for floating your boat.
Okay. Can you give us the names of those rivers and streams?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very interesting question. So the department may be able to answer this question on which rivers and streams have been deemed navigable for tidal by a court. I know the department also has another list that identifies those reaches that they believe they have enough evidence that it could be deemed navigable for tidal. But I'm not, the last time I saw the could be list, I think it was a 2015 list, and I'm not sure I've ever seen, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, I don't know if I've ever seen the list that has those have actually been deemed navigable for tidal.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Thomas, is there something that you could send to Mr. Coleman that we could put up on Teams that would identify those streams, waterways, rivers, whatever we're going to find that are considered navigable?
Mr. Chairman, Sean Thomas again for the record. Certainly get Mr. Coleman the what has been adjudicated by a court segment by segment, as well as our list of what we have historic evidence supporting navigability. So two documents.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Any other questions from the panel? Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably for Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thomas, I just think if I understood this was passed like in this legislation was passed in 2011, and we've only seen 6 permits. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, under this statute for historical uses within the adjudicated segments, yeah, it's correct, 6 permits.
Follow-up?
follow up?
So I guess my thought is this whole statute and process even necessary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know that I'm here to answer questions. I don't know that it's my purview to say whether a statute is necessary or not. Certainly, if you have a diversion or a use of a navigable riverbed that falls within the definition of the statute, it certainly would be useful to the proponents of the bill today.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Seeing none, Senator, would you like to close on your little bill?
I would. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. And I'll just lightly touch a little bit, if I could, Mr. Chair, and then to Representative Galloway. This is extremely important and very much needed, especially if you're one of those diversions that haven't been notified. And if you're not, and then find out that you cannot use your water, yeah, it's needed, which is why it's in front of you today. And you heard some of the testimony that the proponents are all about helping the department get the word out. And I think there was a lack of communication, which the 4 years will take care of. When you come back next session, I think you'll see there will be a lot more applicants in doing this. And then another point, this is only subsection one is what we're looking at, and that's that historic, right, that's been adjudicated already. That date pertains to that. The rest of the subsection two will still remain the same and used as adjudication stretches get done. So a big key is definitely in one and being adjudicated already. So with that, appreciate your questions. It's great. Water's always fun. You never know what you're going to be up against, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you again, Mr. Chair, Committee.
Thank you, Senator Sales. It's always interesting in House Natural Resources. We never know what's going to happen. This is going to close SB 302. We're going to just adjourn for about 5 minutes till 5 o'clock. We've got to wait for our next House, or I guess Representative Logie to get out. So we'll be adjourned for till about 5 o'clock.
Why did Representative Logan
somebody come here today to testify. But you want to stretch for a minute there?
Oh, no, no, let me
see. No, I think I'm going to join you.
The 5 o'clock.
Who are we missing? Representative Malone? Okay, Representative Marler?
Well, we got time. Did he take his mask?
Just ask him. Okay, let's come to order. It's 5 o'clock. I'm going to open the hearing on HB 695. We're going to do EA real quick, and we'll get this kicked out. Oh, you want to give the bill?
Probably just about as quick.
You want to open on your bill, Representative Logie?
Representative Denley Logie, House District 14. The bill... Mr. Chairman, committee, the bill I have before you is just basically authorizing any agencies that are doing permits, leases, contract license, gives them authority if they would like to charge a comment fee, And this comes into play a little bit sometimes. We haven't seen it quite so much on the local level, or the state level, I should say. On the federal level, we see a lot of times there are timber sales that are stopped by a stamp. And the idea here is if you have a lot of people commenting, they'll have a little more stake in the game if the agency wants to put on a $5 fee as a processing for the comments that come in. And I think maybe in the mining industry around Montana, some of the people that are commenting on some of the rules of mining, maybe if they have to put a little stake in the game, they may not put in so many of the frivolous comments. And I think it relays to any of the agencies, if they feel that they're getting a lot of frivolous comments, they have a little bit better way of dealing with it. That's basically what the bill does. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Denley. Do we have any proponents in the House?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alan Olson, and I am here testing Ed has just been a long day.
We understand.
I'm commenting as an individual, Mr. Chairman. I will leave it with the chairman on my way out the door, Representative.
$5 a comment.
You got change.
Oh, you got change.
All right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Logie brought up some good points. This only applies to EISs. This does not apply to rulemaking. An environmental impact statement. All too often, and I've seen this happen quite often on the mining side of our industries in Montana, as well as on the timber side, you get hundreds and hundreds of comments. But all too often, it seems like an overwhelming majority of these comments are form letters or postcards. Substantive comments do make a big difference in the permitting process, in the EIS process. Substantive comments that give you a tool to work with. Mr. Chairman, there is ample opportunity in this bill as well. If you go to page 2, lines 4 and 5, the agency may waive all or a portion of the fee on proof that the commenter payment of the fees constitutes a hardship. I think that's enough of a loophole that if people don't have the funds to participate, they can still be allowed to participate. But like I said, when you get hundreds and hundreds of postcards and form letters that add no substantive information to the process. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Do we have any more proponents in the House? Any proponents? Seeing none, do we have any online? None. Do we have any opponents in the House?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I feel like I'm in a press conference here. For the record, Abigail St. Lawrence, that's ST period, LAWRENCE, here on behalf of the Montana Building Industry Association. It gives us very little pleasure to have to oppose this bill, and I find myself in some strange and possibly uncomfortable company seeing who's standing behind me. But the reality is, when we are talking about environmental impact statements, it is not just the green groups, it is not just environmental or conservation groups who have to comment on those. It is oftentimes industry groups, because when we talk about an environmental impact statement, it has to evaluate all of the options for a permit or a license, the no action alternative, and many other different alternatives. There is value for industry, and we find the folks that I represent find ourselves in the position of having to submit comments on various EISs quite often. Additionally, in my legal side, my life outside this building, I represent a number of agricultural interests and other industry interests, and we often have to submit comments, very substantive comments that I spend a lot of time writing writing that we have to submit on EISs. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I certainly understand that there is the exemption for hardship, but that is fairly undefined in this bill. And additionally, I think it is an impingement on, as I'm sure you'll hear from other folks, Article 2, Section 8 of the Montana Constitution, which is one of our unique provisions that we're proud to have here in Montana, and that is the right to participate. Now, I will admit that that right to participate in Article 2, Section 8 is limited as a reasonable right. So it's not an unlimited right to participate. But when we're talking about fees here, that quite frankly, fees that are unrelated to the burden on the agency, yes, they've got a process. Sometimes those postcards, you all get them here too, the form postcards, but the taking them in is pretty minimal compared to the obligation that they have under the Montana Environmental Policy Act, MEPA, which is where these EISs are done. MEPA and EISs do serve a purpose for industry as well as conservation groups, and for that reason we do have to oppose House Bill 695. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. St. Lawrence. Do we have any more opponents in the room?
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Derf Johnson. That's spelled D-E-R-F-J-O-H-N-S-O-N, and we rise in opposition to this piece of legislation. As mentioned by the previous opponent, Article 2, Section 8 of our Constitution guarantees the fundamental right to participate in governmental decision-making. That right is fundamental, meaning that laws can only restrict or interfere with that right if there's a compelling state interest that is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. What I just heard from the proponents is not a compelling state interest. What I just heard from the proponents is that they don't like the idea of an agency receiving a number of form letters, and therefore we're going to attach a fee to anybody who wants to submit a comment. That not only chills the idea of individuals who may want to submit a comment, but it also interferes with the agency's ability to actually receive information and consider it. Think about the person who has a gravel pit going in next door, and they mail in some comments, and they forget to include a check. Sorry, can't consider it. Think about the individual who wants to support a hard rock mine, because this applies across the board. Sorry, can't consider it if you don't pay a fee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this will chill the fundamental rights of Montanans. It will interfere with agency decision-making. It's very problematic in that regard. There is a line of cases, and the agency has the discretion to weigh and to value the comments that they receive. It's not some sort of contest for who gets the most comments and wins. Otherwise, I think that things would be far different. They get a number of comments, and if they get a number of form letters that they deem to be non-substantive or repetitive, they'll take that into account. This isn't a problem right now. What this bill does is it cures dandruff by decapitation. You may have this small problem, and you're going to say, we're going to set up a whole fee structure associated with engaging with your government, and that's wrong. So we highly recommend not passing this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Do we have any more opponents in the room?
Derf is a lot taller than I am.
Mr. Johnson, you were with MEIC?
Yes, if I neglected to say that, I'm with MEIC, and there's also an individual who is registered online, and she does not need to be called on.
Okay.
Okay,
yes,
I do not have as good of analogies as Derf, but my name is Mackendra Morin, M-O-R-I-N, and I'm here representing the members of Northern Plains Resource Council. We oppose 695 because it puts public participation in the EIS process at a disadvantage. We firmly believe that every Montanan can and should have a say in the decisions that impact their lives. As Durf mentioned, this goes both ways. We don't always have to agree, but we simply think that everyone should have a say in decisions that affect our land and our water. We take issue with the notion that Montanans only get to comment on these if they have the resources to pay for it. We are also concerned that there's nothing in this bill that tells us how much they would have to pay. There's a big difference between $5 and $1,000. Not that we would support $5 either, but we do recognize that the bill allows for the agency to determine whether a fee will create a hardship, but the bill puts the onus of proving that on the commenter. And we have some questions about what would be considered in that determination and how long that could take. Comment periods don't last forever. So depending on how many people apply for that, the comment period could be closed. At the end of the day, we think that pay to play does not result in fair participation in the public process. So we ask this committee to please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moran. Do we have any more opponents in the House?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Colin Cooney, COONEY, here on behalf of Trout Unlimited in opposition to House Bill 695. I'm not going to repeat what you've heard before me, but we do have some serious concerns about how this would affect public participation, which is vital to good government, so we do have to oppose. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooney. Do we have any more opponents in the House? Do we have any opponents online? Okay.
Amy Seaman.
Ms. Seaman.
Chairman, members of the committee, Amy Seaman, S-E-A-M-A-N, here on behalf of Montana Audubon in opposition to this bill, and I appreciate you letting us comment briefly on this as it came up quickly. But we just want to add, for the reasons that you've heard, we are definitely in opposition to this bill, and just recognizing that these environmental impact statements are really there to help our society create and be productive and create harmony between the industry that we know we need to have to survive and to thrive as communities, but also to have the pleasures in life. And I guess want to say that because the comment about this being needed to avoid frivolous comments is unfortunate in that often seems that environmental concerns or comments about the well-being or inherent value of other creatures gets overlooked or lumped into that frivolous category. And it's just such an important part for people to be able to voice their opinions on that impact, because the EISs are often so very, very complicated. Fortunately, they do provide summaries in the beginning, but it's not possible for everybody to dig so deeply into those. And so though some comments may seem less substantial than others, they should be treated equally significantly, and for that reason, we do oppose.
Thank you, Ms. Seaman. Do we have any more opponents online? Seeing none, do we have any informational witnesses in the House? Seeing none, do we have any online?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is Angie Colomaria. I'm the Chief Legal Counsel for the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm here as an informational witness, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Colomaria. Any more informational witnesses online? Okay, seeing none, do we have any questions from the panel? Representative Fielder.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for the sponsor.
For the sponsor, Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fielder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Logie, I've never seen a public agency yet that wouldn't charge a fee if they had the opportunity to. So we'll just assume that's going to happen. But I'm looking at lines, page 2, line, end of line 4 and line 5, where it says the agency may waive all or a portion of the fee on proof by the commenter that payment of the fee constitutes a hardship. And I'm wondering, who in the agency will make that determination, and will they be using past tax returns and lists of assets that the commenter has? How will that line ever be enacted?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fielder, it would be
And I'm saying the agency would make up their guidelines, and I don't have that guideline set up in here. It would be up to the agency to determine what they feel is the hardship, which leaves a little vague, but it's hard to write up depending on which agency you're dealing with.
Follow up?
No, I'm fine.
Representative Malone.
Mr. Chair, question for Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, and I've been in a lot of meetings where I'm the only one not drawing a check.
Sorry, I couldn't.
Not drawing a check.
Ah.
I guess is there any way we could balance this so the public can really have opportunity to respond to a group, since it's, some of these meetings are held in from 8 to noon, and then you have people, bureaucrats, throw out comments that they don't think are substantive. What's the word you used?
Substantive.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess I'll, Mr. Chairman, Representative Malone, that's a fair question. And we as an organization, myself as an individual, love public participation. And the idea that, especially on a major project, an agency would only have one public meeting from 9 to noon, if that was the case, that would be something that we would have a problem with. We want to have as much opportunity for the public to participate as possible, though, so that means if you got a job and you got to work during the day, let's have another meeting at night so that you can get there so you can provide your comment. I guess our concern here is that, well, let's start with $5. Are you going to be ready to, you know, fill in your credit card information, commenting on an EIS? And if it's only $5, are you going to prepare paperwork for a hardship? And Mr. Chairman, the idea that this discretion on the part of the agency, that they have the discretion to violate your fundamental rights, that's just not going to fly. So with that, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Malone, I hope that I've answered your question satisfactorily. I don't know if you have a follow-up.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, and I have to hand it off to environmental groups. They're very good at commenting. They're very good at putting in proper comments. And I'm just asking you, is there a better way for John Doe? You've been to meetings not in your job. Better way to comment. Better way to get public participation.
The COVID situation has really created some opportunities in my mind for state government to really move into some more electronic means for engaging its citizens. And I can tell you that that's some of the silver lining we've seen in people from all across Montana being able to get onto these legislative hearings and provide comments. And I hope that, for example, continues. Additionally, we have that First Amendment right to associate. Anybody can do it. They can create an organization and submit comments the same way any conservation or other organization does. And we support that type of activity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Marler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the bill sponsor.
Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Logie, it sounds like from the tone of this bill hearing that this bill was intentionally to keep environmental groups from commenting on environmental impact statements. How would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would say the idea is to let everybody have a little stake in the game. And you see what we get for our emails here in the legislature, and the idea that if you look at that second page about the third party, and the idea is to have individual comments that come in so everybody is speaking on their own behalf. And if they want to put in the comment, they put a little bit of stake in the game, and then the fees would end up going to some of the costs of the preparation of the documents. But it's not to exclude anybody, but it's to take away that kind of more of that third-party input.
May I ask a follow-up,
Mr. Chair? Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Logie, do you think that we should have a fee for people to comment to the legislature?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I sometimes think maybe that fee on the email, because it plugs up my phone and everything else as far as everyone being able to come here and going to a public meeting. I think that avenue should be open to anyone. But when you start throwing in the letters that come in, comments that are kind of frivolous, that's what I'm trying to keep in check.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I make a quick comment?
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks. I've been in elected service for a long time, and I work at a University of Montana, and I hear some people laughing because I think I don't know why people are laughing, honestly. I think that public participation is one of the most important things that we can do in this country, and I don't think it's very funny.
Well said. Representative France.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To start with just a couple of questions for Ms. Calamaria. Are you there?
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative France.
Yes. Am I right that the end process of an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment is to aid the department in making a decision on some sort of state action, and that the usual at the end of the EIS process, agencies issue a decision notice or some sort of written finding that explains why they reached the decision that they did?
Mr. Chair, Representative France, that's correct.
In your knowledge, has DNRC ever issued a decision notice where they said, well, the overwhelming opposition of the letters that we've received caused us to reject this project? Is that a basis for rejecting permit applications or other state actions?
Representative France, just to clarify real quick, I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality.
DEQ.
I would have to check our records to determine if that has ever happened. We certainly do consider all comments received, and we provide them the weight that we deem necessary, such as substantive comments.
Thank you, Ms. Calamaria. A couple of questions for the sponsor.
Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair, Representative France.
Representative Logie, Mr. Chair, are you aware of decisions by state agencies where they've done a vote count and decided how they should move a decision forward?
Mr. Chair and Representative France, I have heard comments that it's not always run by the numbers game, but the quality of the comment.
Well, and so are we trying to...
Through the chair?
Yeah. Through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's quality comments that make a difference to agencies?
Mr. Chair and Representative France, the substantive comments, yes, rather than just running up a count on the, should we say, like the emails that we get that are almost like a third-party comment.
And, all right.
Follow-up?
I think I'm good, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Any other questions from the panel? I just got one. Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, could you give me the definition of substantive in how it's used in making a comment?
Excellent question, Mr. Chairman. And I think that there might not be any one definition, and I'd probably have to go back and do a little legal research on that as well. However, I think that if you submit 10 pages of technical reports that go down to the specifics, if you are able to demonstrate that you're going to be directly impacted, If you are not associated with a larger comment effort, which I don't mean to denigrate, I think that the petition tools that a lot of organizations use are very useful in engaging the public, and the agency can weigh those. But if you can demonstrate that you have unique individual comments related to a specific project, say you're a landowner adjacent to it, or you have some sort of stake in it, I would consider that substantive as opposed to more of a procedural issue. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir, Mr. Johnson, it does. Thank you. Excellent definition, too. Give you a thumbs up. Any other questions? Representative Galloway?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for Ms. St. Lawrence.
Ms. St. Lawrence.
I think my tongue's wore out, sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Oh, there you are, Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. St. Lawrence. So you commented about how extensive some of your work is and having to write this all out. So I would assume a $5 charge would not be a big deal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, to be clear, I'm doing this on behalf of clients. Second, as you heard from Representative Logie, there's no statement in here as to what the amount of charges will be. And I think actually Representative Fielder made a very good point, and that is, and I've seen this before, that agencies never miss a chance to charge. And, you know, if we're going simply on trying to recover as much as we can to recover costs, I don't know how much that's going to be. And also, to be clear, when I am representing builders, small agricultural interests, I'm often heavily discounting my own legal fees. So, yeah, $5 charge is a lot for those folks. And there's no promise that this will just be a $5 charge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Logie, would you like to close on your bill?
Mr. Chair and committee, I would. In reaction to Representative Fielder's comment on page 2, the hardship, it would be just fine to scratch those two lines out of there because I don't have the fine definition. That would be up to the agencies, the way I felt about it. And also the cost. I know there could be, we could put a limit on it. I think part of the idea, depending on what the study is going to be, how in-depth the environmental impact statement is, and if they'll get a little bit of that money back out of it as a, but the most important part, I think, is for the commenters to have a little stake in the game so they are putting, like say, the substantive comments. As far as when you have meetings and people can go and speak in person, to me that is important, and I don't want to take that away, and I don't want to take an individual's right to comment. But I think I've gone to a lot of meetings and had the chance to speak in person, and I think that is the time to make those comments and not charge there. But when you're sending in the comments that can really affect a big project, and you see the thousands of comments that are just more or less the form letters, that's the part I'm trying to get around and get rid of. So that's basically what the bill is about to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Logie, and this closes HB 695. And seeing's at the late hour of 5:30 and we have to be on the floor, we're going to do EA tomorrow. Same time, same place, 3 o'clock. Or I guess if it's okay with everybody else, we'll do it on adjournment and just really try to quickly knock them out and get out of here. And no, the room's open tomorrow.
Are you against Logie's
thing? We'll take care of that for you. Okay. This closes House Natural Resources.